Welcome back to Uprising. I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. Within hours of Mubarak's resignation on Friday, Mehdi Karoubi, one of Iran's most prominent opposition leaders and clerics, was placed under house arrest for trying to organize a protest today. The government has not officially banned the demonstration, but Iran's Revolutionary Guard threatened to brutally crush any rallies. Two of Karoubi's allies, Taghi Rahmani and Mir Hossein Mousavi, have also been arrested in anticipation of today's protest. President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad's regime experienced its strongest Egypt-like popular revolt in 2009 when the country's largely young population rose up under the banner of the Green Revolution. The Iranian government, despite showing support for the Egyptian and Tunisian uprisings as it celebrates the anniversary of its own 1979 revolution, has been jamming the BBC's Persian service signal since Thursday in an effort to block coverage of Mubarak's fall from power. Reports are coming in from today's demonstrations that security forces have been heavy-handed. Meanwhile, in Algeria, anti-government protests have increased in steam, even as the Algerian government rushed to announce today that it would lift the emergency rule that has been in place since 1992, meeting a key demand of protesters. Yesterday, hundreds of demonstrators clashed with government-backed protesters in the eastern city of Annaba, and on Saturday, defying a police ban, thousands of Algerians marched on the capital, Algiers. They plan to hold weekly demonstrations in Algiers until their demands for reform are met. My guests are Rhys Ehrlich, author of The Iran Agenda, The Real Story of U.S. Policy in the Middle East Crisis, and Conversations with Terrorists, Middle East Leaders on Politics, Violence, and Empire, and David Porter, Professor Emeritus of Political Science at SUNY Empire State College. He just wrote the piece, The Triumph of Leaderless Revolutions. Welcome to Uprising, Rhys and David.
Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks so much for joining us. Well, Rhys, let me start with you. I mentioned the 2009 uprising in Iran, which was dubbed the Green Revolution. Since then, what exactly, before we talk about what unfolded today in Iran, what has happened? What happened to that energy that barely 2 years ago also caught the attention of the world?
I was there at the time of the 2009 elections and observed firsthand what was going on, the massive protests, at least 1 million people in the streets. Some people now say 3 million.
And this was just, as a reminder, was in response to the fact that the elections were supposedly won by Mir Hossein Mousavi, but Ahmadinejad retained power.
Yeah, I think what everybody agreed was that Ahmadinejad did not win by 62% of the vote. People in massive numbers suspected vote fraud and took to the streets in peaceful demonstrations. And those continued for roughly 8 months into the early part of 2010. They were brutally crushed by the Ahmadinejad government, the Revolutionary Guard, and the other armed forces of the state. The sentiment and anger at the government has not dissipated. The ability to express it, however, has. And I think their people in Iran are taking new inspiration from what they saw in Tunisia and Egypt.
Well, what's interesting is the position that the government has taken. On the one hand, in a word, lauding what they're seeing in Egypt and Tunisia and comparing it to the 1979 revolution, but then on the other hand, preventing ordinary Iranians from taking inspiration. Sort of lays bare their hypocrisy.
Yeah, they're trying to claim that the uprisings in Tunisia and Egypt are part of the Islamic Revolution. They simply distort the facts. That's not the folks who were leading it. But they definitely don't want anything like that affecting them back home.
I want to turn to David Porter. Tell us what specifically is happening in Algeria with the lifting, the announcement today that the emergency rule that's been in place since 1992 is going to be lifted. Do you see the president there really trying to preempt an Egypt or Tunisia from taking place?
Yeah, there's no doubt that that is the intent of the regime. I think his days are numbered, President Bouteflika. I think he's been always seen as the lesser of evils by the military leadership that's basically been in control of the Algerian government since the time of independence. He's been in poor health. He has very little public support. And the danger is that certain measures may be taken that look like liberalization, but in fact are simply replacing one president with another appointed basically by the military. And while that may seem like it's in response to the emerging public calls for change in Algeria, in fact, it may just leave the regime pretty much in the same state as before. And then, of course, that's a real danger in Egypt as well.
Hmm. David, in Algeria, what sort of efforts have there been, given that most of our listeners, myself included, may not be as aware of the recent history of Algeria? Have there been attempts by demonstrators, by ordinary Algerians, to get organized? I'm assuming that what we're seeing now didn't come out of a vacuum.
No, not at all. In fact, Algeria has probably been more active in terms of direct demonstrations and riots than any of the other countries in North Africa and Middle East. It's not been something heavily publicized, but over the last year, for example, there were some 10,000 reported local riots or demonstrations against public authorities. And this is an incredible number. And in many cases, probably in most cases, it was simply the poor, enraged young people who feel like they have no future, like they are treated with contempt by local officials. They blockade roadways with burning tires. They attack government buildings. Sometimes they attack party offices. Sometimes the banks and stores that are selling to the affluent Algerians. But it's been very chaotic in the sense that it's not coordinated together. And that's been one of the tragedies. There have been something like 14 Algerians at this point who have set themselves on fire over the last couple months. Horrible, tragic situations where they feel like there's been no real channel for them to express themselves politically except in this kind of structural rioting. So that's the background. And just in the last several weeks, there has been coming together a sort of loose coalition of autonomous trade union leaders, the Human Rights League, a couple of the opposition parties, trying to put together some way to make the opposition more visible to the outside and taken more seriously by the regime. In this last demonstration on Saturday, for example, in Algiers, there was an ex-prime minister and several past cabinet members who actually took part in it. Of course, you know, there's a huge gap between people at that level and the rioting youth that I was talking about, and that's going to be a major challenge to get the kind of energy, the dynamism from the base to connect with people who can also draw more international attention.
Rees Erlich, let's turn to what has happened in Iran today. We just heard, of course, about the demonstrations in Algeria. There were demonstrations Saturday and Sunday. Today was the day that Iranians had called for a major protest in the street modeled on or at least inspired by Egypt. What exactly unfolded, given that some of the top spokespeople and leaders like Mehdi Karoubi were placed under house arrest?
Well, I don't have current information that's later in Iran waiting for more reports on about what's happening.
Because it's just happened hours ago.
Yeah, exactly. If I had to make a guess, I think it's organizing under very difficult circumstances. The government has attempted to intimidate people and making outsized threats against anybody who shows up, etc. I think it's a difficult situation to organize and to bring people out.
The LA Times is reporting that tens of thousands of people have been in the Azadi Square, which also means Liberation Square, Iran's version of Tahrir, if you will. And there are also video clips that are showing university students out and about, but also crackdowns by government forces. Rees, do you think that this could be a resurgence, potentially a resurgence of the Green Revolution of 2009?
It could be. As I mentioned, it's difficult. I'm sure there's going to be very sharp repression. Sentiment, I stay in touch with people in Iran, and the sentiments that were expressed in 2009 to either call for massive reforms of the current system to allow for greater freedoms, but also to deal with the country's serious economic problems of high unemployment and inflation. All of those sentiments are still there, and it could be that the call for these demonstrations will bust loose that anger that's been pent up for a long time. I think what we've seen is that once there's a momentum that starts, it's very difficult for those in power to control.
And Rhys, it sounds like the ingredients for a major resurgence in Iran are all there, same ones that were there in 2009, but just judging from what we've seen unfolding in different Arab and Muslim and Middle Eastern countries across the region, is a largely young population, a largely educated population, and a hugely unemployed population that is tired of state repression. All of those ingredients are in place in Iran, but I think it's just, it seems to me that it's just sheer fear of what the regime is capable of that's holding people back. Is that accurate?
Yeah, no, I think that's accurate. And just as Dr. Porter was explaining about Algeria, so there have been huge number of wildcat strikes in Iran. Again, not reported very often. They tend to be isolated. They might be resolved either through repression or through paying off. For example, workers may not have gotten paid for 3, 4, 5 months, so they pay the back salaries, and that temporarily quells things. But I saw it in 2009, is that it wasn't just the so-called twittering classes, the elite, the wealthy, the educated, but ordinary working Iranians who were out in the streets. Mm-hmm. And the anger is there at the economic situation. The government has imposed austerity measures similar to kind of IMF-imposed neoliberal solutions, getting rid of long-time subsidies, and that has generated anger among ordinary working people. So it could be that we're seeing that anger bursting out.
Now, the major difference between what's happening in Iran and Algeria with what happened in Egypt and Tunisia is the role of the United States. In the cases of Egypt and Tunisia, those dictators were backed heavily by the United States. But in Iran, of course, Iran's government is one of the main enemies of the United States. And in Algeria, David Porter, is the connection essentially with Algeria's ex-colonizer France, or is there a U.S. connection?
Well, there's a connection with both, actually. Algeria has become one of the major exporters of natural gas and oil in the world, and the U.S. is one of its major customers. So there's been a much tighter relationship ever since that kind of economic link has existed. In addition to that, the United States has been trying to press for more Algerian cooperation with the American efforts to develop their own African command to deal with what they regard as potential terrorist movements. And so far, the Algerian military has engaged in a certain amount of collaboration with the United States, but also is reluctant to get too closely involved. The Algerian military has a long history of course, its own self-assertion going all the way back to the revolution of the 1950s and early 60s. But many of the officers of the original leadership and extending all the way down toward the present have actually been trained by the French as well as in past days by the Soviet Union. So there are various kinds of allegiances and ties there, but the United States has definitely been trying to encourage a closer relationship. I wanted to point out one thing about Algeria, which is kind of inhibiting for the development of this kind of mass struggle, and that is that in the 1990s, after a period of brief political liberalization, which occurred after major demonstrations of hundreds of thousands of people in the streets of Algiers, and hundreds of people killed and disappeared, tortured, and so on, that there was, in fact, a major clash, a war between the military and the radical Islamists in the whole decade of the 1990s, which resulted in the deaths of some 200,000 people and the disappearance of many, the torture of many. So that's a very heavy kind of memory that's hanging over Algeria as one of the possible outcomes of this movement towards liberalization, which the regime at the time was able to move towards its own advantage, because they argue that if it's not us, if we go away, the radical Islamists are coming back in again.
Well,
France are beginning to overcome that fear also.
Right, and hence the lifting of the emergency rule law today. David Porter, we'd love to have you back on to see how the situation in Algeria is progressing. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
David Porter is a professor emeritus of political science at SUNY Empire State College. He just wrote the piece, The Triumph of Leaderless Revolutions, which you can find at counterpunch.org. Also, we'll post it on uprisingradio.org later today. Finally, Rhys Ehrlich, you've written The Iran Agenda, The Real Story of U.S. Policy in the Middle East Crisis. We had you on Uprising about your last book, Conversations with Terrorists, Middle East Leaders on Politics, Violence, and Empire. You're also looking at how the unfolding revolutions and uprisings throughout the Middle East, Arab and Muslim world are being viewed here in the United States. Now, with all this talk of democracy, particularly as it was expressed under President Bush, and we assume the right wing of the United States, one would think that most conservatives in the U.S. would be supportive of these revolutions. But is that true?
Well, there was a split, to be honest. Some of the conservatives were at least giving lip service to supporting the people of Egypt once kind of the demonstrations became as huge as they did. But the unrepentant neoconservatives and some supporters of Israel were taking their cues from the leadership in Israel, and they put forward the slogan, one man, one vote, one time. And that's supposed to express the idea that Muslim extremists might participate in elections and then never allow them to take place again. And they stirred up that fear, and you could see it to some extent even among liberal supporters of Israel and certainly among the neoconservative crowd. The problem with that argument is it never actually happened. There's never been a case of free and fair elections taking place with the Islamists then seizing power as a result of that. There have been revolutions and upheavals and civil wars where people have come to power, but never through free and fair elections. And actually, the opposite is the case. When the U.S. doesn't like the results of elections, for example, the Palestinian Authority in 2006 when Hamas won, they're the ones who have blocked any future elections from taking place. It's the U.S. who never wants to see one election, let alone multiple elections, which their forces lose.
Well, Rhys, listeners can find your work at your website, rhysehrlich.com, and we'll link to that from our site, uprisingradio.org, later today as well.
Good.
I want to thank you so much for joining us today.
Always a pleasure.
Rhys Ehrlich is author of The Iran Agenda, The Real Story of U.S. Policy in the Middle East Crisis, and his latest book, Conversations with Terrorists, Middle East Leaders on Politics, Violence, and Empire. Again, his website, Rhys Ehrlich, that's spelled R-E-E-S-E, ERLICH.com. We've been talking about the unfolding uprisings in Iran as well as in Algeria.